What has happened to the flying saucers? For better than 20 years, flying saucers have been popping in and out of the headlines. At certain times, across the span of years, they have been genuinely big news. Somehow, though, even the top UFO stories have had a way of fading out slowly, often giving way to fresher, more confounding, but equally unprovable UFO stories, but just as likely phasing out beneath the push of another, more dynamic story in another area of the news. The American preoccupation with the UFO phenomenon, whatever it is, has been apparently decreasing. With the release of the Common Report, some people think the whole matter of flying saucers is at an end. With the flights of Apollo 11 and 12 and the transmission of space pictures that are beyond dispute, some people ask how it is that we cannot obtain UFO or flying saucer pictures that are beyond dispute. On the other hand, some people believe that with the retirement of the Air Force from the field of UFOs, a whole new can of worms or flying saucers has been opened up. Our guest tonight, for 13 years, the director of the National Investigating Committee for Aerial Phenomenon, NICAP, Major Donald Keel, on the long-distance phone. And here in the studio, one of America's best-known artists and lecturers and writers in the field of ufology, Earl Ness. Major Keel, welcome to this broadcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What is the ufological verdict on the Condon Report? What do ufology people, what does NICAP say, and people who are acquainted with UFOs?
Well, we work very closely with them in order to be sure that they would have all the good information available, and that was a definite request. We helped train the field teams, and we kept on until we found out that they were following a negative course, obviously intended to wipe out any belief in these things.
Is it your belief, Major, that this was a preconditioned course, that they would...
I won't say that it was prearranged. I would say this, that at the very start, Dr. Collins said, well, I'm an agnostic, I've always believed that these things could be explained. We had all the evidence, which is the usual Air Force claim. And then later, when the president asked him, what about the possibility the Air Force was withholding information? He said, well, a lot of people believe they are. I don't think so. But maybe they are, and even if they are, I don't care much. And we thought that was an extremely odd statement for a man who's supposed to be in charge of a NICAP project. Although most of the scientists on the project were quite serious and neutral and trying to get answers. But in the end, the Condon Report examined only about 90 cases out of some 11 or 12,000 on record, and we had made available hundreds and hundreds of the best ones to them. Mm-hmm. We gave them the names of hundreds of top-rated observers, veteran pilots and scientists, electronic experts, even astronauts. And
which astronaut?
He never interviewed a single one of these people. Condon did not. Mm-hmm. He confined himself, most of his interviews, I think it was over a dozen, were with people who, for instance, one man who claimed that he'd met a Martian on a road out in Nebraska.
Yes.
They took him to the Colorado Project and hypnotized him to see if he could get his true story. But that is about the wildest extreme that you can get. So our opinion of the Condon Report diminished to the point where we stopped furnishing him with cases.
Which astronaut's names did you give him?
I beg pardon?
I said, which astronaut's names did you give him?
James McDivitt. He saw three UFOs on an orbit and photographed one of them, and that photograph still has never been explained, although they were attached. There were several others who had sighted objects, one of them in a polar orbit. They never did get the details on that, but NASA has those cases on file. But Condon later said that, the windows of those things were smudged and these men were under nervous strain and very busy and so forth. It implied that, to me that implies incompetence. And there's nothing more incompetent, no one more incompetent in flying any kind of machine today than those highly trained astronauts.
I've forgotten which it was. John Byrne, wasn't it, who first reported
the Firefly.
The Firefly.
Yes, well,
we found out what those were, didn't we?
Those things were apparently linked with something connected with the capsule itself. things that keep break flake off and so forth. But this other object was a large thing. It photographed a bigger object with a projection like a radar spout.
Now, what we learned from the NASA people was that the fireflies were actually ice crystals. Ice crystals that were, you see, the astronauts have an elimination system that passes out of the capsule, and what they do is they avoid flushing toilets while the plane is standing in the station, but when they're out there in orbit, I don't know quite what phrase to use, but it gets out there into outer space. And what John Glenn saw as fireflies were actually urine crystals.
Well, now that was a later explanation. The first one was that they thought that it was something flaking off under the heat near the exhaust, the jet exhaust. But that was later discarded, and then this other was brought in. But those reports I don't consider important because they were of very tiny things. I'm talking about objects of considerable size that have been reported.
Well, in the Glenn case, the ice crystals were nevertheless unidentified flying objects, at least for a while.
Technically, yes. Yes, that's right. But I don't think we never considered them as something of sudden extreme importance. We thought there was some logical explanation that would be found shortly. While in the McDonough case, there never was one, and we followed that very closely for over 2 years. But, of course, that's just one case. The main way of evidence in the UFO thing is it has never been explained. You have over 3,000 top-rated observers, and they go from well-known scientists on down to veteran pilots of all the military services, all the major airlines, in abroad as well as here, tower operators, radar trackers, satellite trackers, besides very expert observers on the ground, people who are intelligent men and women, but I'm talking about the people who are specially trained. Now, either all of them are wrong, they're incompetent, or they were deluded, or practical jokers or something. And that means all of them. I don't mean 99.9%. I mean 100%. Or some of those reports are correct. Now, we could spend 5 hours just reading names, which would impress a lot of people, I think. But it's all on the record. And the Condon Project, they got around that very neatly by simply evading back to everything that happened before the project opened.
You mentioned with regard to the man who was compiling, I guess it was Condon, who said to refer to himself as an agnostic. Was that the word you used?
Yes.
In using that term, does that mean that there's a feeling that ufology has a kind of a religious quality to it?
No. He meant by that, an agnostic means I am a disbeliever. I do not believe, but if you can prove it to me, maybe I will believe it. But since then, he has said it was a crook type of operation, and he's been in the report. He says that many pilots and witnesses get together afterwards and talk it over so the stories match. In other words, he gives no credit to the NASA witnesses for being honest, careful, and reliable people. This is the way they did a long time ago when the Air Force started out. You shouldn't really blame the Air Force. They were caught in a spot. There was excitement and people were hysterical. Some people have been buzzed on the highways or in aircraft by flying discs or other UFO objects. And there was actually a desire to play this down. So the policy was to explain them away and as quickly as possible, whatever seemed logical. And several times when the first answer didn't stick, they changed it to another one. Now, I know the people who connected with this, some of them in the Air Force press desk and a few in the project. And they didn't like it any more than the people that were combating them, because they said, but we're up against it here. We have to try to find some logical answers. In some places, there weren't any. And the Air Force secretly has proved a long time ago that these things were not anything made on this earth, and they were real, and they were superior to any earth-made devices.
How do you know that, Major?
I can't nail it down at the moment, but I have in my possession a document which admits such a thing, admits the existence. I was told that anyway by 3 Air Force intelligence officers who were connected with the investigations, one of them the director of intelligence. It said it was true, but they simply did not feel that it had to be released, and General Vandenberg fought very hard against releasing it, and that was when the policy was changed to complete debunking.
But we don't always know that military men are always right. We know that General Westmoreland in 1967 said we were winning the war in Vietnam. The next thing we knew, in 68 came along, we had the Tet Offensive. So we cannot assume that just because men belong to the Air Force and what they conclude or what they say in documents are necessarily correct.
Well, that's true. But this thing was not one man's opinion. This was an evaluation by a large group of people who had been on this for a long time.
Thinking for the Air Force then as a body?
A special body assigned to evaluate these things, mm-hmm. including civilian scientists as well as Air Force intelligence people and others.
Major, may we ask you to hold on a moment? We have a commercial coming up. In a moment, I want to come back with our guests, Major Donald Kehoe and Mr. Earl Ness, and ask about the meaning of the Air Force retiring from the UFO business, what this may mean to UFO research, what we can look forward to in the future, or not look forward to, as the case may be. We'll be back after these words. Now, gentlemen, what does the retirement of the Air Force from the UFO affair mean? Why did they get out? First of all, why did they get out?
Is that a question to me?
It could be, Major. Yes, why not?
All right. Now, it may be interesting to know that this is the second time the Air Force has made the identical announcement. Stated that the project was closed, all sightings were explained, natural phenomena, delusions, hoaxes, and so forth and so forth. Then, they went underground, and for approximately a year and a half, all investigations were conducted in secret, and the reports were kept secret. Then there was an outbreak of sightings at the salt bank, but they had to come out openly and investigate them, and then they said they admitted that the project had never been closed. This is exactly what's going on today. There is an air defense directive which states that any object, unknown object, which is picked up in the skies, apparently moving under control, which is tracked by radar or seen visually, must be investigated and, if possible, intercepted. An Air Force jet interceptor is sent up under the command of air defense to try to force these things down or identify them. Now, that is today just the same as it was last year or 10 years ago.
Now, that would be logical, wouldn't it, Major Keogh?
Right. And the project is not closed. What they are just saying, in effect, is Project Blue Book is closed. They may have changed the name,
mm-hmm.
or they may have said, this is not a project. And then they go along and they will say, there is a new organization here, and we're going to do this. But the Air Force is still mildly concerned in this. You see, they hope that the Carter Report would shoot these things down completely. And we could see that was the purpose a long time ago as far as the Air Force is concerned. They gambled that this would happen because Carter was an agnostic, and they figured that he probably was going to be very hard to convince. Then there was a split among the scientists in that project, and two of them got fired, essentially, because they were trying to differ with him. But then, anyway, this unexplained evidence still exists, and there are hundreds of pilots who are just waiting their chance to come forward when some of the ridicule is lifted, come forward in a body and say, look, here is the evidence. We saw it. We saw these things closely. Many people aboard the plane saw them. They were tracked. They were photographed. It's there, and let's stop fooling about it and get it out in the open. Now, that's exactly what we've been trying to do for years, and coming awfully close.
What do you mean close, sir?
Well, two or three times, in the excitement in 1957, and later on in 65 and 66, there were so many sightings pouring in, and even Air Force pilots were putting them on record, and Air Force intelligence almost lost control. The newspapers were kneeling them and say, come on, it's time you were talking. What's going on here? So they just by pure luck, stumbled on something. In one case, some man came out with one of these wire contact claims that I talked with two or three spacemen when they landed near my field or something like that. And that just had right, and immediately all of the serious studies ended. But behind it, just kept right on. And it's going on. They spent a very large sum of money. And today, if you got right down inside of it, you would find that not only some very high Air Force officers, but there are other people connected with the government who are involved in this.
Major and Mr. Neff, we haven't even heard from Earl Neff yet.
The silent member here, and
yeah.
I wanted to hear what Major had.
Any comment from you, Major, about the psychosexual aspects of flying saucers? Do you think that's
important? Of course there are lots of people like that who've been involved. Most of those contact cases that we investigated appears to be the delusions, actual true delusions. People believe the things that they were not so, or they were playing frauds, or people trying to sell something.
What about the case of the Brazilian farm boy who claims that his thoughts had landed, I believe it was
Antonio?
Brazil.
Yeah, I know that
Antonio,
one.
And he claimed that he was raped by a woman from outer space.
I stopped Alan the night I told this many years ago.
I remember Dr. Carmen. He wanted to get some real juicy reading about this and about this. And then he held up the book in which this thing was described.
Yeah.
But I think that this has never been really nailed down. And it's sort of one of those things that trails off into thin air, extremely unlikely. And of course, in many things, it's almost, you can't say anything impossible these days. But I would say that I wouldn't believe that unless I saw it happen.
I really. I wouldn't want. I am curious about his face.
Well, I think we ought to leave off from that. We are talking tonight to Major Donald Kehoe on the long distance line. And with us in the studio is the famed ufologist Earl Metz. Now, if you want to call us early tonight, by all means do, because we're going to open the lines early. And as a matter of fact, in just a moment, coming back from the next announcement. I think before we go to the telephones, I have but one more question remaining, maybe two. Do there exist any actual artifacts of space, or are the moon rocks all we got?
You want me to answer this, or Major?
Anybody.
Major, just jump in. All I was going to say was that Ab Alamogordo is, Tucson now, caller ends, and of course has had these pieces of magnesium orthosilicate, very, very pure material that the Air Force had borrowed a small piece from her some years ago and burned it, which is understandable. After all, the stuff does burn very readily. But they wanted another piece which to refuse because there wasn't too much of it to give. But that reportedly was from the exploded one off the Brazilian coast. Now, I do know that Dr. Weber...
Exploded one what?
UFO, pardon me.
A UFO exploded off the Brazilian coast?
That was the story that Weber told as how the pieces were obtained.
Mm.
But then, of course, there was the late Dr. Wilbert Smith of Canada's Project Magnet, similar to our Project Sign, Project Wedge, Project Twinkle, Project Blue Book, et cetera, et cetera. And he claimed that he had been handed a piece while in Washington by Admiral Knowles. And over this very microphone many years ago, Admiral Herbert D. Knowles, and you know him well, Major, don't you?
Yes, yes.
Board member, NICAP, he told me right here and told the audience, the radio audience on the air, that he had actually handed this piece to Dr. Wilbert Smith. Now, half of the piece of that kind had been analyzed later by Dr. Smith in Shirley Bay up in Canada, where the project headquarters was. And it was very, very unusual material. Frank Edwards knew a lot about it, and over these very microphones also told about it. They had little tiny dimples in the metal, thousands of them within a small area under the microscope showed.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting part of this metal was there seemed there was no danger for it. It was a strange metal, unknown to us. That's all I can tell you about. How about you, Major?
Yes, I knew about that. As a matter of fact, the Air Force knew about that also.
Yes.
There's one thing I'd like to speak to here quickly. Mr. Davis, you mentioned about the lack of pictures.
Yes.
In the Carlin report, they go into the photographic analysis, goes very detailed investigation of them. Many no Oregon pictures and states in there that, so far as they can find out, these people saw exactly what they reported. They're very large. Unknown, disc-shaped or disc-shaped object, approximately so wide, so forth, maneuvering at high speed, and then all this, and it goes into the reasons why they accept this as probably a genuine UFO.
Mm-hmm.
But up in the front of the report, Dr. Carlin says we were unable to make a photogrammetric analysis of this picture.
Well, what do you mean by genuine UFO?
That's the word of the analysis, the photographic experts that reported on this, that it appears to be exactly what they said. Now, there are two other cases in that report. Contradicting Carmen's own words in the beginning, people said this appears to be a case of a genuine UFO, meaning a genuine unidentified flying object.
Well, now, what is a genuine? Now, that's what I got.
It's reported by the RAS in England, and the report of this jet pilot chasing one of these things and seeing it and being tracked by radio at the same time.
So, well, now, Major, how would you define a genuine unidentified flying object?
A genuine unidentified flying object, to me, means one which is some object leaving under intelligent control, which is not any Earth-made aircraft or spacecraft or any type of device made on Earth, which is performing the maneuvers described, superior, such as complete reversal in a matter of seconds and acceleration to tremendous speed and so forth. That type of thing, a UFO is capable of doing. Now, when you have a report like that, as much as this is apparently a genuine UFO, they mean we're not going to explain this away in the usual, with the usual answers.
Now, in a moment, we're going to go to the telephones. I just wanted to read to you a lab report on an artifact issued by the Smith Emery Company, Chemist Testing Inspection Engineers, 781 East Washington Boulevard, Los Angeles 21, California. It is dated May the 5th of 1966. The report of qualitative spectrographic examination. Ash, 74.07%. Major constituents, 10% or greater, lead. Intermediate constituents, 2 to 10%, iron, silver, sodium, zinc, potassium, and tungsten. Minor constituents, that is to say 1% or less, tin, copper, silicon, cadmium, boron, antimony, aluminum, nickel, chromium, bismuth, molybdenum, zirconium, cobalt, magnesium, manganese, calcium, vanadium, other elements, non-detected qualitative tests for mercury, present. Now, this is a spectrographic examination that was issued to, and a copy of the report given to me by, of all people, Daniel Fry.
Oh, no.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Now, notice I groaned.
I know you did. I know you did. Now, and also, now Major Keyhole groaned.
Oh, I laughed.
Well, you did. Was it all right? Here's a man who says he has seen these things. He said he had a ride on one in 1950-something.
A white sand incident.
He showed me, he brought this artifact in the studio and showed it to me. It looked like a washer. But here is the oddest spectrographic analysis I have ever seen.
Do you want me to bring in a piece that I have that has a spectrographic analysis made by Kent State University and by some other places? One very, very important one that I can't reveal where it was made. Well, it is under those conditions that they did it for me secretly. But if I have the analysis, I have it all in writing, I'd be very happy to show it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so hard, it'll cut glass, just like a diamond, mm-hmm. and yet there is not one trace of carbon in it.
Now, what are you telling us, Earl, that anybody can produce an artifact?
No, this was obtained in rather unusual way on a desert.
Relatively rough terrain,
I should say, in this country. And after an object that reportedly had landed, apparently having trouble, and then took off. Now, an object of this kind of UFO type of object.
Then you believe this to be an object?
I do not know if the story is genuine or false, but it was told to me, the piece of metal was loaned to me, and strangely enough, it was Robert Smith, Dr. Smith of Canada's Project Magnet, who stated he felt, and maybe I'd be interested in knowing your reaction on this, he said that he felt that any piece of metal, or hardware as he referred to so often, from outer space would be free of carbon. This has no trace of carbon, and that's so hard, it's like a diamond, it cuts glass. And very, very hard. I spent hours trying to cut it with a molybdenum blade, mm-hmm. and finally had to resort to power, and then only was I able to saw through it with a rubber wheel that was impregnated with diamond dust.
Well, now getting back to the artifact in the possession of Dr. Fry,
right.
What do you make of that? Where does that tell you? Does anybody can make an artifact, and that artifacts tell you nothing?
No, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that. I think that it depends as much as anything, just like a sighting, on the credibility of the viewer or the possessor. And in this particular case, I am very questioning the gentleman who presented it.
Anything to add here, Major Keogh, before we take a telephone call?
Well, there's one more thing that I really wanted to bring in the question. I mentioned the Air Force Project report. This is a publication which NICAP has put out. We got it through the Launch Committee. They helped us break the secrecy. For years, the Air Force denied these things existed. Air Force Project Reports 1 to 12. We got them, and they have the photostats of the original reports, Air Force Intelligence Reports, with a stamp, secret or confidential, on no man knows on one side, unclassified, after they were forced to release them. Now, this thing proves that for years, while they were saying we are not withholding a thing here, they were sitting on secret reports Parts and all kinds of observers in the United States who were some of the strangest reports that ever came in. Now, that thing is available to anybody who wants to depict it. As a matter of fact, I can't publish it, but if anyone in Congress, anywhere, a newspaper man wants to, could go up to the NICAP office, 1536 Connecticut Avenue, Washington, D.C., and can see these documents and see all this proof. Proof of suppression of evidence.
Major, if the people think that the Air Force doesn't take some stock in this, how do they account for the fact that the Air Force has just very recently produced a most interesting book, a very, very heavy book, I have it here before me, it's called UFOs and Related Subjects in the Amateur Bibliography, and Lynn E. Cato of the Library of Congress is responsible for it, the Air Force Office of Scientific Research that is responsible for producing it.
I know. Well, if you don't think they don't take stock in it, here's this report last year of Colonel Robert M. Terman, TIRN, an Air Force flight surgeon, flying in a KC-35 aerial tanker over Asia on a daylight mission. He heard the pilots up in the cockpit screaming over the intercom, and he ran up there to see, and here was this huge cylindrical object holding altitude, same altitude as the aircraft, apparently as if observing him. And the crew, the pilots, and Colonel Terman were astounded. They were watching it. The senior pilot radioed for jet interceptors. There was no sign of hostility. He radioed for them anyway, just in case. And then he very cautiously tried to bank in for a closer look. Everything accelerated without a sight flash. Now, this is a report, official report, given to the Air Force that's on the record. Colonel Robert M. Terman.
Even Arthur Godfrey had a very close one.
What do you mean,
years ago, as a pilot coming into Philadelphia, a UFO was seen off his right wing. He radioed the field, and the field said, there's nothing up there. He said, I know darn well there is. And then the object went behind the plane, came in from the rear toward the left wing, and every move that he made, it duplicated until it finally zipped off into space again. But Godfrey's a doggone good pilot, and his co-pilot was with him at the time, so they both witnessed it.
What about the pilot for the Henry Ford II?
Yeah.
Henry Ford II and the nine Ford officials, high officials, flying in a company executive plane to the top pilot, and they saw this gigantic object facing them, and Ford... He directed the pilot to give a report to NICAP. We have the pilot's report, and he said it was absolutely baffling the way the thing kept pace with him. And Ford confirmed that he'd watched it for over an hour while it was trailing him, pacing him.
Well, were they able to watch it when it was not pacing him?
I tell you, I wonder how the psychiatrist would explain to him.
Who, me?
He is one of their subjects, a psycho subject, and he's doing an awfully good job in his industry.
Well, I don't know what his hang-ups are, and I wouldn't even speak to explain. I don't even know him. And I bet you he doesn't even know me.
Well, I'll give you some more names. Lieutenant Colonel Charles Cook, who headed the Air Force, originally the Air Force Intelligence Digest, and evaluated over 700 cases, and he says these things are absolutely true. They're extraterrestrial, and he said, we used to call the boys in Project Blue Book the Little Blue Boys. That's how much respect he had for them.
Maybe if we may, the phones are absolutely jammed, and we really should open up the lines and give them a chance, because I know they're calling partly because they want to talk to you. As a matter of fact, probably mainly because they want to talk to you. Next, they will be calling to talk to Earl F., and last, and certainly least, they will be calling to talk to me. I think we should therefore go to the phones after we pause for these commercial words. Let's take a telephone call, shall we, from the Cleveland area, and put them together with our guests. Hello, you're on the air with Major Kehoe, Mr. Ness.
I'd like to direct my question to Major Keel.
Yes, go ahead.
It concerns an article I came across that appeared in the December 18th issue of New York Times. The article mainly concerned the closing of Project Blue Book. But in one part of the article, it stated that a retired Air Force Colonel, Joseph Bryan, was the acting director of NICAP. Mm-hmm. Now, if this is true, why wasn't this made known to the NICAP members, which I am a member of?
Well, I'll tell you, this is going to be... I knew that question was coming up. There's been some confusion about this thing. And it'll be clarified probably by the part of January. There's going to be a board meeting. What happened was that NICAP, they were considering changes in the reorganization, particularly in business procedures and so forth. And I, frankly, for a long time, would like to get out from under that and handle technical matters, which I probably will do in the future. But he should have been named as the acting president of NICAP. That's a corporation title. He's the chairman of the board of NICAP, and he is the acting president. Gordon Lohr was secretary treasurer. He was listed as the financial representative because there has to be someone living in Washington. So those were technical things connected with the corporation. It was an error in the statement.
This was made known in NICAP's location, though, actually.
Well, yes. I'm sorry that was not actually. I tried to get one out earlier. But I can tell you this, I believe that although there's been a bad situation caused by the Condon report, which caused a drop in public sightings, there's plenty of them, but they don't come out in public, we've had some trouble, but it looks now as though things are going to improve, and I hope any other members listening will be encouraged to hang on, and I think in the near future there's going to be some very interesting developments.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for calling, sir. A call from Pittsburgh. Hello, you're on the air. Thank you for waiting.
I would like to ask why some of the large organizations studying the UFO problem, such as NICAP or APRO, and who have access to the documents of UFO suppression, and also the good photographs of unidentified flying objects, such as those of the Trinidad Isle,
what good one?
The McMinnville, Oregon sightings, why can't these be placed in the news media, perhaps front page, so that we can counter the Air Force's closing of the Project Blue Book, et cetera, to keep this in the mind eye of the public?
Well, let me quickly answer this to you, and then I'm sure the Major has the words for you also. I have been a newspaper man myself, 2 years with the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and was called in on special assignments for the Cleveland Press while Louis Seltzer was the editor there. And I think, the answer to your question about the McMinnville case, also the Trinidad Island, because they're both excellent photographs, or rather there are four down in Trinidad. But news-wise, this is old stuff. These have been known for years, and even Willie Lay, the late Willie Lay, student of Dr. Obeth, was skeptical of those, and yet he couldn't say they weren't real, the Trinidad ones. But I think that their answer would be, as newspaper people, is these have been printed many, many times before. Why should we reproduce these again? How about that, Major?
Well, that's the general reason. Of course, if they were to be reproduced with an authoritative statement by some top expert who would say, these are old pictures, but they're the ones that the Air Force has denied were real all this time, and now here they are, and it's proof they are real, then you would get them on.
Right.
Back in there. And the McMinnville one came very close. When the Condon report mentioned it and said practically that it was a genuine one. But I agree, you will not get these things back, and it's very hard to buck the Air Force announcement that everything is closed, because it's natural to respect your institutions and hope that they're dealing straight with you. And I'm not saying that they're being dishonest. They're really people that lay down the policy are following what they think is the best policy for the country. It's like the CIA some time ago said that in effect, American people were dumb. That wasn't the word they used, but easily bamboozled or something like that. And therefore, that this thing should be debunked because you get people excited. You simply cannot, right now, get any big front page story unless there's some new sighting or some sighting that's broken out from the ones that the Air Force is now investigating in secret. You just can't do it. I know some things that will break it, and I've been trying independently as NICAP to get to some of these things sprung open. Because in one case I know of, one case alone would end this, would break it wide open if you could get the group involved to talk. It involves about 35 pilots. And it's a case that's been suppressed for so long that practically nobody will talk about it unless you get you in a room and make sure you don't have a tape recorder under your coat and so on. But something like that will happen eventually, and it will break, and at that time, the people who've been withholding reports so they wouldn't be ridiculed, they just pour them out and they collect. Because I know a lot of people who send them to us and sent them to me confidentially, saying don't even mention the city, the time, or anything. If it ever happens, it comes open, I'll talk.
It's been a long wait, Major.
Hmm?
It's been a long wait.
No, it's been a long wait. I sometimes wish I'd never heard of these things or I'd gotten into it.
That's what I feel often, too.
I had the freelance writer and lecturer when I got started there.
Mm.
But don't you feel that the ufologist as a whole shouldn't take too negative an attitude, because this 136th
national meeting of AAAS, the American Association of Advancement of Science, is held up in Boston, Mass. At, on the 26th and 27th of December this past year. When that took place, I understand that Dr. Condon tried very, very hard to, by sending out a 7-page letter to all of these members of the Academy of Science, and even to Thomas Paine, who is the Minister of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Now, if he's trying so desperately to a symposium by a man who would be discussing the UFO situation, I think they must be rather desperate. And I think it's mighty time that you, Alan, and the producer here, Bill Baker, and NBC are permitting us to give the kind of information we are over here.
We are fearless. There's no question about that. And intrepid as well.
Yeah, but you're doing a great service because...
There has
been a big flap. Probably can't just have saw it. At one time, according to the Gallup poll, was up 46%. But anyway, there are millions of people that are convinced that there's something to it. And many of them convinced that they're extraterrestrial. But they're afraid to say so. And the newspapers follow the official line as a rule, not only. And until you get something so terrific that it just simply can't be stopped. Like some top man who said, look, I was in on it. I helped initiate the policy. It's wrong, and here's the facts. So what? Something like that. It will do it. And I think, honestly, I don't think that it can go on too much longer. I would be surprised if 1970 ended without some very surprising change in this thing.
Excuse me one second, Major Kehoe and Mr. Neff. We have to pause for a belated station identification. Donald Kehoe can stay with us only another 10 minutes, so we are going to take advantage of that by getting right back to the phones and doing business with the customers. Hello, you're on the air. Thank you for waiting.
You know, one thing has always been a fascinating thing to me is the UFO propulsion system. What do you feel is the type of propulsion that these UFOs are using?
Major?
Oh, well, as I say, I wouldn't trust myself on that because we've asked some of our technical scientific advisors, and they all come out and say, well, it's possibly this and possibly that, but the only person I know that's come out and made a definite commitment was Oberst, who said that it was connected with the control of gravity, and I understand how by having an artificial gravity field, you can drag air molecules along with you and cut down the friction you normally have from heat, and you can get very high speed and acceleration, and without any of those effects, and it also changes the effect of the sonic going through the sound barrier. But as for specifics on exactly how the propulsion is operated, I don't know. I read about 200 scientific and technical explanations of it, and each one of them has a slightly different idea.
Major, do you recall many years ago the Cleveland Ufology Project, which I've been the director, along with the fine group down in Akron, financed a book showing that 84 cases that you folks in Washington had at the time where electromagnetic effects apparently had stalled the engines of autos and the planes.
Well, I agree with that, but that's not...
We don't know how
we tie it into the propulsion system, although I have no doubt
there's
connection in there of a force field.
Yeah.
But I thought the gentleman was asking for a specific explanation of the propulsion system.
Yes.
Which I don't think anybody has. Oh, there's no question about the electromagnetic interference.
I just thought I should throw that in case he was at all in doubt on that.
Yeah, well, you have seen many cases on record where there's stalled automobile ignition, radio turnout lights. Police cars have had that happen. TVs in homes, electric appliances, and so on. And in aircraft, you've had radio direction finders burn out, transmitters burn out, receivers burn out. And many things of that kind have happened when UFOs were in close proximity. And it's probably, it's undoubtedly true that some things of the unified field theory applies in there. Electricity, magnetism, and gravity are all different phases of the same thing. And
there are also electrical failures when UFOs are not in close proximity.
Yeah, they do too. But the ones that I take as more probably true are those where something was relatively close and there were enough witnesses nearby and the car was seen to be stolen and so forth. When you have a single witness, I don't say the man is lying, but it is a big help to have more than one witness.
There is another factor that is usually added when we say the car stalls. We usually, we don't always, but it is not unusual to hear that the dogs bark. There seems to be an equation between howling dogs, frightened dogs, and the appearance of UFOs.
Well, that was brought out in the Exeter case, and, well, Dr. Heinig, who was for 20 years the Air Force chief consultant on this subject, until he began to criticize the Air Force policy, and that time, for some strange reason, his contract was ended. But anyway,
following the bomb gas fiasco, wasn't it?
He said that he has read enough of these reports to accept them as certainly serious, and they should be investigated.
Indeed, yes.
And since animals do have different ranges of hearing, it's quite possible that they're getting vibrations, sound waves, or some kind of waves that we don't hear.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't discount all of these things are tied in with UFOs. They may not all of them be completely true, but there are some of them that have proved to be, in the case of electromagnetic effects, there's enough proof in there that I would personally accept it.
Another call from Cleveland. Hello, you're on the air. Thank you for waiting.
I'd like to direct my question to Major Kehoe.
Go ahead.
Throughout the years, most of my, as I recall, about 6 or 7 years ago, I read in a newspaper, one of the Cleveland papers, involving the U.S. Navy and the Polaris missile. I can't recall the year, but I assume it was around 1961 or 62. Polaris missile launchings in the Atlantic, I believe. And the Polaris missile was launched. I don't recall what altitude it was, but it was pretty high up.
That was down at Cape Canaveral or Cape Kennedy.
I assume so.
I know that case. I saw a copy of the log on it.
The tracking locked onto a UFO much larger than the Polaris missile itself, and it was so close to the missile that the tracking locked onto the UFO instead and tracked the UFO rather than the Polaris missile.
That's right. It did it for 14 minutes.
Right. This was significant to me. From the standpoint that it was acknowledged by the U.S. Navy that they had a radar contact.
Well, now I don't remember just using this type of story. I'm basing my knowledge of my statements entirely on having seen a photostat of the log.
Well, this is what I see.
It said, and they call it unidentifiable, which is the term the Navy has used a number of times where the Air Force uses the word identified.
Well, the reason it interested me was the fact that I saw a brief article, it was only about 4 or 5 paragraphs. I never saw anything after that. And I looked for weeks after that, and I couldn't obtain any more information.
I'll tell you where they got it. They got it from NICAP, because I wrote that particular report myself, and they put it in our publication for members, which is called the UFO Investigator.
Uh-huh.
And I distinctly remember putting in all the details which I was allowed to use about it. I was not supposed to give the source or anything, but I was down at Cape Kennedy and talked with people there, and one of the engineers gave me a copy of that.
Fantastic.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for calling, sir.
Thank you.
And I'd like to express our thanks tonight, Earl Ness, and mine to Major Daniel Kehoe for spending this time with us tonight. He's a busy man, and I know that his granting this time to us was at personal expense to him, and so we are delighted for having had this gift.
Well, thank you very much, and if you have any inquiries and so on, well, later on, maybe sometime I can come back with some interesting new developments, and it would be a pleasure to talk with your audience again.
Very good.
Thank you, Major.
I look forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you,
thank you very much, Major.
Goodbye, Major.